Today's Teisho will be on case 14 in the Book of Serenity. Case 14 is entitled, Attendant Wool Passes Tea. Introduction, probing pole in hand, shadowing grass around him. Sometimes he wraps a ball of silk in iron. Sometimes he wraps a special stone with silk. To determine the soft by means of the hard is of course right. What about the matter of being weak when meeting strength? Case. Attendant Wool asked Deshan, where have all the sages since antiquity gone? Deshan said, what? How's that? Wu said, the order was for a flying dragon horse, but a lame tortoise showed up. Deshan let it rest. The next day, when Deshan came out of the bath, Wu passed him some tea. Deshan patted Wu on the back. Wu said, this old fellow has finally gotten a glimpse. Again, Deshan let the matter rest. Verse, coming right up face to face, an adept knows. Here, sparks and lightning are slow. The plotter who lost the moment has a deep intent to fool the enemy army into not thinking ahead. Each shot a sure hit. Who's fooled anymore? When you see jowls from behind his head, the man is hard to run afoul of. Setting his eyes under his eyebrows, he got the advantage. So I want to thank you all for coming today to practice Zen and for sitting so well, both those of you who are online and those of you who are here in person. You know, what we're doing makes a little sense to people now. It probably didn't make much sense to people 20 years ago. And for a long time before that, in the Western world, what we're doing really made no sense at all, right? So, before you heard about Zen, before you ever practiced meditation, you know, you thought you had a mind, right? So you might have even said, I have a mind of my own, or maybe your parents said about you, oh, he has a mind of his own. You know, we thought we had a mind, and everybody around us thought they had a mind, but actually, from the Zen standpoint, they were you could say, like zombies, right? A zombie is a person who is alive but dead, right? So the person is a body walking around, but there's different kinds of zombies, as you know, if you watch zombie movies. Some of them are very slow and some of them are very fast. Some of them seem to be capable of having an emotional life, but the classic zombie is just a body with no consciousness, right? And to be a zombie is thought to be a great misfortune, and as it is indeed a great misfortune. And what people don't realize is that most of their lives, and in fact throughout most of human history, people have been zombies, not really human beings, we could say. And that may sound odd because, you know, when you were a little kid, you probably read books, you watched television, you know, maybe you had fantasies, you know. When I was a kid, I would just go out on a walk and I would just be in a dream world of my own imagination, right? When you grow up, you have your phone, you know, you can get information on the phone. You have libraries full of books you can read. But actually, you're still a zombie from a Buddhist standpoint. The average person is very much a zombie. One of the zombies in this case is this person, Attendant Wo. Attendant Wo asked Deshan, right, who's the master, the Shifu, where have all the sages since antiquity gone? Deshan pretends not to even be paying attention. He says, what? What was that? And Wo thinks, oh, this is the so-called Chan master, the so-called Zen master. He isn't even paying attention. See, I caught him. See, Wo says, the order was for a flying dragon horse, but what shows up is a lame tortoise. In other words, that's kind of an insult, right? He's saying, I thought a Roshi was supposed to be a flying dragon horse, and you're like a tortoise with an injured leg, right? But Deshan doesn't do anything because he already showed him something, and Attendant Wo didn't notice it, right? So, you know, Deshan showed him, but Wo wasn't ready to see it, see? So anyway, the next day, Deshan came out of the bath and Wo passed him some tea. Deshan patted Wo on the back, and Wo said, this old fellow has finally gotten a glimpse. Again, Deshan let the matter rest. So one of the questions this koan raises is, what is it that Attendant Wo is not seeing? And then did he see it at the end? See, did he see it? Did he see something? Did he change? Did he have an insight or not? So I would say that Attendant Wo is in the category of the people I was speaking of as zombies, right? I was a zombie most of my life until I started meditating. Most people would have said I had a very active life, very active mental life, very active inner life, but actually I didn't. I was a zombie. So it's true. I read a lot of books. I was one of these kids who, you know, because I wasn't very good at sports or other activities, my idea of a good day, of a good weekend, was just to get a really good book and just read it all weekend, and occasionally come downstairs for something to eat, and then go back up and read. I would read like for 10 hours a day, I think, or 8 hours a day sometimes, and you know, I was just, we would say, lost in a book. And as I said, you know, I had a fairly active fantasy life. I would go outside and relive these stories that I'd read and imagine myself as a hero. And that's sort of the life I think most of us have, right? I mean, we think we have an active intellectual life, but really, we have never really encountered the mind. The mind. So, I started sitting with Takabayashi Genki Roshi in Seattle around 1976, something like that. And I had heard that this Japanese monk had just come to the United States, and he was holding a meditation at the University of Washington. And I started sitting there, and for reasons I didn't understand, meditation really helped me an enormous amount. Hearing about that meditation session at the university was such great luck, because it's totally transformed my life. You know, I was tend to be kind of like a fearful person and a catastrophizer. I don't know if you know what that word means, but even from the time I was a little kid, I was like always expecting some catastrophe, So you know, when I was a young adult, that definitely haunted me, right? I mean, there were lots of things in my life, in my early life, I didn't do because I was fearful and catastrophizing. So, you know, if you are, part of you wants to do something and you're afraid to do it, even though part of you wants to do something, and you distrust yourself or you fear your judgment and you fear that the outcome is going to be bad, you're always caught like in this double bind. You know, you're always distrusting yourself and you're always afraid to try the thing that might make you happier or more fulfilled. And so, you know, I would say that when I was in my early 20s, I was sort of like, I wasn't clinically depressed, but being in that sort of double bind situation all the time, I think made me somewhat depressed and unhappy, and I couldn't have explained it in a million years. So I heard about this meditation session at the university that was held every Wednesday. And I went to sit, and you know, the first time I went there, I had never meditated before. There were mats just like in this room. And I sat down on the cushion, and a person showed me basically how to meditate. And after about 10 minutes, it was just so hard. You know, I think I was actually sweating. Right? I wasn't sitting in the lotus position. That's for sure. I was just sitting with my legs crossed in front of me. But it was just so challenging to sit still. And I tried to do what the instructor had told me to do, which was to watch my breath. And as soon as I started to try to watch my breath, right, the thoughts, it was just like this flood of thoughts, and some of those thoughts would trigger powerful emotions, right? And you know, I would keep trying to get back to the breath. At the end of, we sat at the University of Washington, we would sit for about 30 minutes. We sat very much like here, a 30-minute period, a 30-minute period, and a 20 or 25-minute period. That was the evening. And after my first session, I barely made it through the last period of meditation. I was just like, all I could do was think of getting home and watching TV or something. But you know, it helped me. For reasons I didn't understand, meditating really helped me, even though if you asked me to describe what happened, I never stayed with my breath more than a couple of seconds. So, you know, I started going back every Wednesday night, pretty much without fail. And I would try to watch my breath, and I would try to watch my breath. And, you know, I was, you know, very rarely successful. You know, I often would start meditating, and then I'd think of something that was bothering me, and I would think about it obsessively and catastrophize and so on. But I'd get off the cushion, I'd feel better. So I kept going. And I remember I was asked to do some house sitting at this very large empty house where I was living. And it was winter, and the house was very poorly heated. And I was supposed to like stay for a while and take care of the house until my friends got back. And you know, it was never really totally warm except in the kitchen. But I was, you know, trying to continue to meditate, even though I was away from my community. I was in this other place. And I remember, you know, sitting down on the cushion and, you know, being a little cold. And watching my breath. And then all of a sudden, it was like, it was just like somebody had turned the screen of the computer off. Right, and it was just blank. And
I had never had an experience like that before. But it was just like a, it was just like a big, it was just like total blankness or total darkness for some period of time. It really lasted, I don't know how long, I didn't look at my watch, but it was so shocking, you know, that I remembered it. I had all of these, like you would say, we could say, terrible sits, you know, where my mind was buzzing like a beehive. And I it was a little cold. I was watching my breath. I've been doing this for months, really. And I felt better, but suddenly I just had this experience of this complete blankness. And, you know, I got off the cushion and, you know, actually that experience in that form didn't come back for some time. But it's, I remembered it, right? It was just like, oh, that was really unlike anything I had ever experienced. So, you know, when I was back sitting with my community, you know, I wasn't able to get back to that place for a while. And I was working with my teacher on the breath koan. My teacher, Genki Roshi, had said, you know, please watch the breath, okay? And I would watch the breath, but I would have like, I'd think, well, what am I supposed to do with this? You know, why did he give me this? You know, I know how to breathe. I know I'd watch my breath go in, I'd watch my breath go out. I wrote little poems. You know, I tried to, when I would go in to meet the teacher in Dokusan, I tried to do something creative with my koan. And it wasn't really until many years later that I had another encounter with that blankness. But, you know, I would say that my encounter with that blankness was the first time I wasn't a zombie. You know, it's like my road out of zombiehood. You know, people, I work in an English department. I hang out with people who read philosophy for the, in their spare time. That's their recreation. It's, they read philosophy, right? And they take ideas so seriously. And it, and I worshipped those people for so many years. You know, I thought those people were like the highest human beings, right? And meanwhile, I was doing Zen practice as a graduate student, and then after I continued for many, many years. And it took me a long time to realize what had happened to me, you know. And I was a little bit like attendant Wo in this koan. You know, Wo is a monk. He's been sitting, but he hasn't experienced blank mind, or he hasn't put the pieces together, you know. I don't know if you ever have had this experience where you have an earworm, you know? You know what, everybody knows what it, do young people still say earworm? Is that still a term? It means a piece of music that gets into your head and you can't get it out of your head. I remember years ago going to a session with a person who said that he spent 5 days listening to this song from a television show. He couldn't get it out of his head. It was like a torture for him. But, you know, maybe you've had that experience where you hear a piece of music and then it's with you. You can't, it's like you can't shake it. Oh, no. I even heard on NPR, there was a story about earworms, and somebody played this piece of music, and the reporter said, oh my God, I'm so sorry I heard that. Now I won't be able to stop hearing that for hours, right? You know, ideas, information, music, all of those are like earworms, right? They're like earworms. You know, we pick them up, and we internalize them. We sort of like hold on to them. And they sort of get stored away in our minds. You know, if you're meditating, you know, sometimes you'll remember things you had completely forgotten about for 20 years, or if you're a little younger, for 15 years or 10 years. We pick up ideas, and ideas sort of like colonize our minds. Yeah, they colonize our minds. You know, actually, people who are in the music business, they actually write songs that will be earworms. What they want is a song, is we say catchy tune. What they mean is they want something that's really going to stick in your mind, right? They want something that's going to stick in your mind and stay with you, right? It's almost like they want to infect you with an idea or infect you with a piece of music. And if the little piece of music can just get stuck in your head right long enough, you know, you'll begin to think it's yours, right? So, you know, a friend of mine has, I don't have this in my car, but a friend of mine has Sirius satellite radio in the car. And I was in the car with this person, and the music, it's like all the great music that I grew up with when I was in my, you know, 20s and 30s, all this classic rock. And it was, oh my God, that's so beautiful, right? You know, it felt like it was mine or like it was me. You know, people will hear music and think, oh, that's our song, right? I'm not knocking it. But basically we pick up ideas, pieces of music, images, and they're sticky, you know, they stay with us, and they fill our consciousness, and they are in like general circulation in our consciousness, and we think they're ours, right? And they really fill up our attention, right? So when you sit down on the cushion, if you haven't meditated much, you could kind of see this for yourself. You know, people who haven't meditated think their minds are calm and empty. You know, they might even say, I don't have a thought in my head. It's like, no, you haven't meditated, you know. When you sit down on the cushion and you start meditating, you realize it's like a roaring river of these little memes, these little scraps of information. And, you know, if you're a beginner, in meditation, it's almost impossible to get through these memes to any sort of unmoving place in your mind, right? So you sit down on the cushion and you start replaying a movie that you saw last night, you know, and then you think about what you're going to eat and so on. It's just like this nonstop circulation of these like memes, like these pieces of information. Right? And a lot of them trigger powerful emotional responses and so on. And we call this our mind, you know, so we call this our mind because we haven't really ever experienced mind. And for most people go through their whole lives and they've never been able to separate themselves from the memes that are circulating in their consciousness. It's like the memes are like all these little leaves that are carried down the stream. And there's so many leaves that you can't see the water, right? This is really how it is. And if people, or if you ask somebody, well, describe the creek to me, they say, well, it was a moving sheet of leaves, right? He said, did you notice the water? What water? Right? I just saw leaves moving through this channel. So that's really how it is, right? And memes that are floating around, filling our consciousness and floating by, rushing by very rapidly, these can feel like ours, right? But they're not ours. They don't belong to you, even if you feel attached to them. You know, it takes a long time in meditation to free yourself from the spell of these memes, right? You know, some of our idea, you know, sometimes we'll be thinking about something and we'll think really hard and we'll come up with a solution. And we might think that's really an original solution. Then you realize 10 million people just had that same. Ideas are like money, right? Ideas are like money. You know, when you pull a dollar bill out of your wallet, you say, this is my dollar bill. And if somebody tries to take it from you, depending on the circumstances, you might give it to them or fight for it. But it's not your dollar bill. It's in general circulation, right? Ideas are just like this. Even emotions are just like this, right? You know, so when we're little kids, you know, we're little kids are constantly watching other people trying to decide how they should respond to things that happen. You know, so, you learn that when your father looks a certain way, you should straighten up and not fool around, right? And you realize that, you know, at the birthday party for your cousin, you're not the star. You have to, like, tone it down, sit quietly, look at your cousin because he's the star. You know, we get this whole repertoire of how to behave and how to feel. You know, we think our emotions are natural, but they're not natural. They're like thoroughly conditioned, right? So how we respond to things, when we respond to things, we have like emotions that seem to rise up naturally. But actually, my view is we learn those. We learn those from watching tens of thousands of hours of TV, right? You know, reading books or interacting with people in social situations where we learned what was expected of us, right? You know, at an Irish funeral, everybody tells jokes, right? But if you're not at an Irish funeral, it's really bad taste to tell jokes. And you can say, well, which is the right way, telling jokes at funerals or not telling? You know, it's just a socially acceptable, like, dream, right? So we picked up lessons about how to feel, what to think. And, you know, in a way, we're like robots or we're like zombies. You know, so I'll never forget, when I was in college, I had a relationship with somebody. This young woman and I would often wind up in a place where we would be arguing. And there was a lot of tension, a lot of conflict, right? But, you know, I think because there were also other emotional elements to our relationship, we didn't break it off. We kept trying to work it out. You know, we were like 19-year-olds who didn't have any skills. And it was a terrible relationship. And I remember that when it finally broke off, you know, I had like the ambivalent feelings because I felt like I was not a lovable person, and that made me sad and insecure. But on the other hand, you know, there was like under the surface, there was like this real joy. And I didn't let myself experience it until years later. I saw this movie with Steve Martin where this woman he was in a relationship with broke off their relationship, and he pretended to be sad. And then he walks out the door. He says, well, goodbye. I wish you the best. And as he's going down the stairs, he's transformed. His face is filled with joy, right? He leaps off. It's like finally he's free. I didn't know you could feel that way. I didn't know you were allowed to feel that way, like free. Oh, my God. Thank God I've been let out of jail, right? I didn't, you know, and it's like, I like that from therapy. They say, I didn't give myself permission to enjoy that story. But anyway, you know, we live our lives thinking that we are the authors of our own scripts, right? We create our own lives. We create our own emotions. We create our own thoughts. And I'm not trying to undermine you, but actually, if you look at your thoughts, if you look at your emotions, you look at, you know, a lot of what we do are they're like stereotypes, or they're like movies you've seen, or there's a movie that's not a very good movie that I wouldn't recommend, but it has a it's called Scrooged. It's with Bill Murray, and it's a pretty bad movie, I would say. But when he has childhood memories, somebody said, "You didn't have a childhood," and he said, "Oh, I did have a childhood," and he describes what happened. And everything he remembers as his childhood actually happened in a TV show he watched when he was a kid. You know, and that's funny, right? But actually, in a certain way, that's true for all of us, right? We've just been acting out the scripts of our culture, right? Or the scripts that our parents wrote for us and their parents wrote for them. So you know, most of the time, we're responding to events in a way that's thoroughly conditioned by our life experiences and by our culture. And we think we're free, but we're not, right? And we think we're thinking, or we think we're feeling, but it's just like a little tape recorder is playing in our heads, telling us what to think, or telling us, you know, we're just circulating the dollar bills we call our emotions or our thoughts. So this is kind of the truth, in a way, I would say. And people don't wake up from this. They just keep acting out these scripts, even though the scripts cause them so much suffering and confusion, because the scripts can't be trusted a lot of the time, right? So for example, my father got married twice. He got married to my mother, and then he got married the second time. And the first time he had three children, and he was never home because he was working so hard. And eventually he got divorced because he was never home, and had his relationship with my mother fell apart. So then he remarried and did exactly the same thing again, you know, and, you know, he did exactly, it was like the same, it was like, take two, you know, in a movie set, take two, different leading lady this time, his second wife, right? But my father kept acting out the script, right? He both wanted to have a wonderful family, and he was so obsessive in his work that he had no time for his family. And, you know, these two rules, or these two sets of instructions, drove him to drink. He developed a drinking problem. But he couldn't step back and say, wait, you know, who wrote these scripts? Why am I behaving this way? See? So, you know, to some degree, we're all a little like this, right? And so, you know, that day that I was sitting in a freezing cold house sitting in a February day and watching my breath, and I suddenly found this blank, it was like I fell off a cliff into this blank place. That was the first time I encountered my mind. That's like the first time the leaves cleared away, and under the leaves I could see the clear water flowing. Right, which has no color and no, you know, once we discover that still blankness, our relationship to our ideas and emotions can change. It's like we will stop being a robot. Now we will stop being a zombie, right? Because, you know, the thoughts we've been having aren't really our thoughts. They're programming. Let's say our programming. And the emotions we've been having, we always feel like our emotions are the truest thing. But actually, our emotions are also programmed. you know, if I may say so. So when you have this moment where suddenly all of that stops, you know, one of the things that begins to happen to you when you meditate is you stop behaving in these conditioned ways. So look, you know, sometimes you will find maybe that something just sets you, this might not be your personality, but you might find that something just sets you off. It like lights your fuse, right? It's like something happens and then it's just like 0 to 60, right? And then afterwards you're full of regret. You say, why did I do that, right? Well, you did that because the script you've been following told you to do that. So you know, when you start meditating, you learn how to ground your awareness in that still, empty place. And the more you go back there, the more you're able to free yourself from your conditioning, right? So, you know, it will happen to you that if you have like an anger management issue, you know, just saying don't be angry doesn't help, right? But if you can ground yourself in that blank, empty place, you know, suddenly at some point you're going to experience the anger differently, right? You're going to be sitting in that calm, empty place, and it's like you see the event, you see the anger arising, right? But you don't own the anger. It's not your anger, it's just anger. It's like a cloud going by in the sky. See, before you saw the clear sky, all you saw were clouds, and you didn't know there was a clear sky behind the clouds. That's sort of how it is, right? You know, when you can find the clear sky that never changes, that never moves, you see the clouds come and go. Now you're not drawn forward compulsively by the clouds, right? So this, you know, this maybe there's an event that you don't know why, but it triggered, you know, anger is arising. And, you know, in the old days, before you meditated, you would just, that anger was you, it was yours, and you just acted it out, right? You got angry, you either exploded or you bottled it up. But instead, you see the anger arising, and you realize that that's not who I am. I don't have to, that anger is not me. That anger is not my true nature. I'm here in this stillness, right? And the anger just comes and goes, right? That is real liberation. It's not enlightenment, but that's real liberation. That's the most precious thing in the world, to be able to, my sister.
Recording stopped.
Pardon me.
Recording in progress.
Sorry. My sister has worked for NSAID. I don't know if I mentioned that, but she has lost her job recently, you know. And, you know, when something like that happens to you, you have all these scripts, right? You're supposed to be devastated. You're supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to feel unworthy and so on and so on. These are all like, you know, and, you know, my half-sister doesn't meditate, but, you know, I've been able to see her, you know, try to ground herself in other ways, right? You know, she's spending a lot of time with her mother, and she does a lot of work in the community, like civic good work, you know, she's doing that kind of thing. So it's similar, trying to free herself from those scripts. But, you know, we go through our whole lives a little bit like, attendant. Right? We're just acting out the scripts, and we haven't seen, it's like, we see half of reality, right? So we see half of reality. You know, it's like all we see is the world of form. All we see are the memes in circulation. We don't see the mind behind the memes, right? And so, you know, our view of the world is really very limited. It's like all we see are the clouds. We don't see the sky. And, you know, and once you begin to encounter that blank mind, right, that still, empty, unmoving mind, you know, you are on the road to awakening. And awakening is like this process of deconditioning, right? Deconditioning. So, you know, every time you sit down on the cushion, you know, you probably, I remember when I started training seriously with Genki Roshi, you know, I would go down to the Zen Center with my friend John in South Seattle. And I would sit in the morning, we would start, I think, at 5:30 in the morning. And Genki would always open the windows, just like in a monastery, you know, no heat, it would be freezing cold. And Japanese monastery, and we would, you know, sit in the cold. And my first thought was always, what am I doing here? You know, I'm in graduate school. I should be at home studying. I should be whatever, you know. And then I would think, oh, I'm going to fail. I'd go through all these scripts, right? And of course, I couldn't leave anyway because John was sitting there. He wasn't going to drive back to central Seattle. So finally, I just realized, oh, I can't go. And then I just gave up and I went into that emptiness. And at the end of a morning sit, I would feel so wonderful, so free. It's like we all have, you know, we're all deeply programmed, right? And you can't trust Microsoft. You can't trust Facebook. You can't, why would you trust your cultural programming, right? We're all deeply programmed. And the programs were written by people who didn't necessarily understand reality either and didn't have your best interests at heart, right? So you know, when people think about Zen practice, they might not think of it this way, but it's learning to be aware of this, of mind, right? Which is not the contents of mind. It's this blue sky behind the clouds. It's this clear water that carries all these leaves down to the ocean, right? And you know, gradually in Zen, we encounter this meme, and it triggers all these emotional responses, and then we, you know, gradually let that go, and it stops having any power over us. And we go through this thousands of times probably in our Zen practice. You know, attendant Kuo just hasn't noticed this yet. But, you know, Dishan knows he's, sooner or later, if he keeps practicing, he's going to notice. He's going to have a day where suddenly he realizes, oh my God, you know, my mind is absolutely formless and timeless and empty. You know, and he won't stay there. He won't be able to stay there. He'll come back and he'll worry about, you know, some detail of the, you know, the meal was late at noon or something if he's managing the monastery. But little by little, he is working through all of these conditioned responses, and his mind is, little by little, he's going to be calmer, happier person, fearless, you know, grounded. All of these things follow from this simple experience of we say in Zen, wuxin. You know, that wuxin is the first, your first true encounter with the mind. And all of the koan training that we do in Zen is about, you know, another cloud comes by and it triggers the fear, triggers the regret, and, you know, we just keep going back to the blue sky of mind, you know, and gradually the cloud dissipates, and now we're free. Now we're more alert. Now we're more aware. It's there, and you just have to keep returning to it, and that's the path. Probing pole in hand, shadowing grass around him, Sometimes he wraps a ball of silk in iron. Sometimes he wraps a special stone with silk. To determine the soft by means of the hard is, of course, right. What about the matter of being weak when meeting strength? We all rely on comparisons. We all rely on, these are conditioned responses. You know, what about the matter of being weak when meeting? If you're strong and you meet weakness, do this. If you're weak and you encounter strength, what should you do? You know, who cares, right? Those are all just memes. Those are all just leaves floating on the water. These are false issues. They're issues of no importance. Attendant Wo asked Deshan, where have all the sages since antiquity gone? You know, they know about Wuxin. They know about Wuxin. Deshan tries to show him what Wuxin is, right? He's like, huh? Who cares? You know, who cares about the sages of antiquity? You know, look at your own mind. It's empty and blank right now. But, you know, Wo was not ready. And Wo doesn't get it at all. He thinks, I was thinking you were going to say something profound. The most profound thing has just been revealed to him by Deshan, which is the empty mind. I thought the order was for a flying dragon horse, but a lame tortoise showed up. Deshan knows he's just not ready yet. The next day, when Deshan came out of the bath, Wo passed him some tea. Deshan patted Wo on the back. Wo said, this old fellow has finally gotten a glimpse. Again, Deshan let the matter rest. So does he see it now or not, right? That you'll have to tell me when we work together on this koan. Verse, coming right up face to face, an adept knows. Here, sparks and lightning are slow. The plotter who lost the moment has a deep intent. To fool the enemy army is not thinking ahead. Each shot a sure hit. Who's fooled anymore? When you see jowls from behind his head, the man is hard to run afoul of. Setting his eyes under his eyebrows, he got the advantage.